Brethren, you made it. You made it here. And that's important. And I want to, I want to discuss with you today the absolute uniqueness of the Feast of Tabernacles. Have you ever done a comparison between the spring holy days and the fall holy days? They're only 6 months apart. The calendar of holy days only occupies half of a 12-month calendar. But principally, there are usually 7 days plus one, a quasi 8 days. Some are holy, some are not. Unleavened bread has two holy days within the week, and Passover is not, neither is the wave sheaf. Tabernacles is one holy day in its week, and the eighth is holy. The spring begins the holy day season, and we are now at the very end. And we will have to wait another 5 to 6 months for spring holy days. The Feast of Tabernacles is a remembrance that God has protected, will protect, and does protect, and provides a hope for his people. And that one day, as you heard today, and you will hear throughout the feast, this day will be the first day of the rest of your life. The Tabernacles of a seventh-day celebration, apart from the eighth day, is really two feasts. It has a duality. In fact, it has two names, as most of the holy days do. You may not have noticed, but they do have. Turn with me, if you would, to Exodus chapter 23, beginning in verse 16. I think it's important that you're going to see these two words behind me, probably most of the feast. They're still there, aren't they? Good. In Exodus chapter 23, in verse 16, as Fred said earlier, I think it was here last night. It says, the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which is talking about the spring holy days, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering at the end of the year when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. So it is called, not here the Feast of Tabernacles, but the Feast of Harvest. The Feast of Ingathering, or the Feast of Harvest, is a completely different Hebrew word than we will see later. And then we still observe it. But it has another name, and I'm going to ask you to turn to Leviticus chapter 23. I must tell you that in most of the ministry's Bibles, if they have put any mileage on them, Leviticus chapter 23 is got to be, without a doubt, one of, if not the, most marked up sections in their Bible. Now, I'm not asking you to grab some minister's Bible after this message, but it's usually marked up a lot of notes, highlights, and that's because it is so very, very important. In Leviticus chapter 23, verse 33, we read, "Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, saying, The 15th day of the seventh month, today, shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to the Lord. On the first day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. For 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. It is a sacred assembly, and you shall do no customary work on it." This is important. This is a different feast name. It is Sukkot, and you've heard that term very often. This time of year, the Jews will use the word Sukkot or Sukkoth. It's a different word than ingathering, but it is the same period of time. Sukkot you're familiar with. But because there's two names, it speaks to what we call a duality of the feast. The inherent text is here in Leviticus. Abraham Block, in a classic work some 40 years ago of the biblical and historical background of Jewish customs and ceremonies, said, "The repetition and sequence of the portion becomes clear if we bear in mind the dual character of Sukkot, the Feast of Booths." Verse 34 introduces us to this name. We'll now read the rest of these verses. In verse 37, "These are the feasts of the Lord which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, to offer an offering made by fire to the Lord, a burnt offering and a grain offering and a sacrifice and drink offering, besides the Sabbath of the Lord, which are gifts, besides your vows, besides your freewill offerings." Verse 39. He repeats, "Also on the 15th day of the seventh month, today, when you have entered in the fruit of the land, and you shall keep the feast of the Lord for 7 days, on the first day there shall be a Sabbath rest, and on the eighth day a Sabbath rest." You can see he's repeating himself. but it is different. And you shall take for yourselves of the first day of the fruit of beautiful trees and branches of palm trees and boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. You shall keep it as a feast of the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All you who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So Moses declared to the children of Israel the feasts of the Lord. You can see there's a repetition. The word tabernacle is at most translations in our New King James that we use a lot. It says tabernacle. Is this the word Sukkot? When we see the word booths later in these ending verses, it's the same word. But they're different in context. Block goes on. The verses 39 to 43 are supply the background and to point out that Sukkot does not supersede the Feast of Ingathering, but coexists with it. This is indicated by the restatement of the date. In other words, there is a concurrent date for both holidays, the agricultural and the historical. It's two feasts. It is one feast. But it has this duality of meaning. There is, in most Bibles, more black ink attributed to the Feast of Tabernacles than the other feasts. Not because so much it's more important, because the depth of meaning of these days we could not cover in six feasts. There's that much information. Edersheim, as well as others, note this duality. In his Temple and its Ministry, Edersheim writes, "The harvest thanksgiving of the Feast of Tabernacles reminded Israel, on the one hand, of their dwelling in booths in the wilderness, while on the other hand, it pointed to the final harvest, when Israel's mission would be completed, and all the nations gathered unto the Lord." So we have here in Leviticus an agricultural and we have a historical aspect of the tabernacles that we observe, and they're equally important. The other reason is of great depth, this spiritual dimension, as we shall see. It also may speak to the ancient age of these days, long before Moses giving the law at Sinai. We think of that in many of the feast days, that they had an agricultural counterpart, possibly in the time of Abraham. They're that old. But as historical events appear, as the wandering of Israel, the exodus from Egypt, the holy days took on this massive historical proportion, and that's equally important. There is another reason that is some great depth to these days. There's no work to be done. In the first section, there's no work to be done, but there are lots of sacrifices. In fact, today, if you read Numbers 13, there are more sacrifices done on this day than any other single day in the Bible. Numbers 13 says, 13 bulls from the herd, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, a year old, and shall be without blemish, and their grain offering of fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah. 29 animals just on this day. And every day succeeding, it decreases. That's a lot of sacrifices. So these sacrifices, we gave an offering. We don't slaughter bulls and goats anymore, or rams, or heifers, because we believe one person gave that ultimate sacrifice. But we gave an offering nonetheless, and we do take up offerings on high days because of this. It has, we call the theological perspective. It has this idea of redemption for Israel, forgiveness. That's the perspective. And then we have this transition in verse 39, kind of like a recapitulation. Also on the 15th day of the seventh month, again, when you have gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of the Eternal for 7 days. There shall be a Sabbath rest. This time it's different. And you shall take for yourselves on the first day fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, boughs of leafy trees, and willows. This is more, or semi, an agricultural, but it's for a completely different reason. It's semi-agricultural. It's to build a shelter, a tabernacle, the Sukkot, a hut. It goes by various names in the Old Testament. It is a temporary dwelling. There's 3 full verses of gathering these branches and fruits. We used to live on the East Coast near New York, And all about this time when we would go to services just before Sukkot, Tabernacles. We would see the Jewish families preparing their Sukkot. It is a fascinating, fascinating culture. You can buy a kit ready to assemble in New York. Only in New York can you do that. It is truly interesting. So there's this agricultural aspect to a shelter. And it says you'll build the shelter for 7 days. Now, I've noticed, and as have others, that many of you have booked rooms here at the feast for 8, 9, 10, and more days. Not allowed. 7 only. The deacons will be looking at the housing dates. I'm kidding. He says in verse 43, why is this being built? Verse 43 is very clear. And sometimes we overlook it. We are in dwellings that are temporary this week, so that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. That is why. The harvest and the historical event are important. First, the harvest. Those of you that are involved at all in agriculture will know what I'm talking about. The harvest is everything. If you don't harvest, you don't... Very good. You don't eat. I'm the son of a farmer, and I can tell you a number of dinner table meetings, when my mouth was full, I was reminded that this food came from a farmer. By the way, I saw a license plate. Is somebody here from Iowa? Is somebody here from Iowa? Okay, you don't want to. All right, I wouldn't either. My dad was from Iowa, and I think the song leader is originally from Iowa. I think we're related. He was from Iowa, and I was told often this food came from a field, not from Piggly Wiggly. Wiggly Piggly? Was it Piggly Wiggly? I was going to Google it. I forgot it. It didn't come from Vaughn's. It didn't come from, I know, Holy of Holies. This will be difficult for many of you to understand, especially younger people. The food doesn't come from Trader Joe's. It comes, I know. Counsel those people over here. All right. I'm trying to reach out to some of our non-California brethren. Harvest time was the time. It was that important. And sometimes we can lose that perspective in our modern society. You collected the family, the friends. After the harvest, you thanked God for his providence. There was this ingathering. You rejoiced. We are thankful to God during this Feast of Tabernacles. The ingathering is twofold. Not only does it bring in families, as it does here at our feast. As we heard earlier, it brings in the nations in the final days. It has all this great depth of meaning. First, we know that these nations come together after they have been built, after they have been beaten in battle against Christ. That's another aspect of this feast. 1,000 years of the nations are together in peace. You dwell in booths this week for a reason. And he says to us that your generations may know. Why? Why are the generations to know? Who's the you in your generation? Who is Moses, who's God, through Moses, speaking to? Why a booth? Why a temporary dwelling? Why? It's important. I want you to reflect on this just a short bit. And I'm going to enter the area that Mr. Hall so eloquently put before you. We're going to do a little bit of dark work here. I'm going to take you back to those days he referenced. We're going to spend some time there. The Israelites have been released from Egypt at the Passover. We celebrate. That's what it pictures. They crossed the wilderness, the desert. And in approximately the second year on their way to the Canaan, the Promised Land, they're asked to spy out the land that they're about to enter. Turn with me to one of the most neglected scriptures in all the Bible, Numbers 13. We will not spend a lot of time here, but it is important for the backstory. Numbers 13, verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the children of Israel. From each of the tribe of the fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. And indeed, that is exactly what he did. He sent them out, and they were to come back with a report. Jump with me to verse 26, the report. Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And if you'll remember, they had poles that they would, the big pieces of fruit, that the land is bountiful. And so they showed them the fruit of the land. Verse 27, and then they told him and said, we went to the land where you sent us. We have good news and we have unbelievably rotten, horrible news. I'm skipping ahead. It's not in the Hebrew, but you'll get the point. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. However, nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. They go on to say, we are grasshoppers compared to these people. We know that Caleb and Joshua both attempt to quell the mob, the angry mob. The Israelites are furious. It does no good. They threaten to stone them. And in chapter 14, verses 1 through 4, again, these are some of the most pivotal verses in the entire Old Testament, because it sets the tone for the history of the rest of Israel. And brethren, I think if you do the math, this happened in one day. It's why it's called the Day of Provocation. So all the congregation, verse 1 of 14, lifted up their voices and cried, and all the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, if only we had died in this wilderness, why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. You will not find in all of the Bible more wild and crazy and disrespectful verses or comments in the entire Word of God. And it set the Israelites back for decades and decades and decades. Those five wild accusations, they had rejected God, they despised God, His miracles, His works, all He had done in Egypt in the wilderness. God tells Moses, wipe them out. Easy fix. Wipe them out. And I'll start over with you, Moses. Brand new. Moses pleads with God. God relents. But God sets the history. He changes Israel forever. And it is why we are at the Feast of Tabernacles and why you are in a temporary dwelling. Numbers chapter 14, verse 26. I want you to listen to the words carefully because it sets forward the tone. And again, it speaks to what Mr. Hall had said earlier. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation and complain against me? I have heard the complaints which the children of Israel make against me. Say to them, as I live, the Lord, says the Lord, just as you have spoken, He is going to make them eat every word they said. In my hearing I have heard these words, just as you have spoken, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness. All of you were numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above. I want you to think about that statement. We read through that so quickly. Mr. Weber, earlier today, not going to ask you to do it again. Everybody 18 and below stood up. You don't have to do it again. I want you to remember that, as it couldn't have been more poignant from what I'm about to tell you. Everybody that didn't stand up, if it was Israel, died in the wilderness. The percentages were huge. And the children watched it happen slowly. He says, your carcasses, he says, your verse 31, but your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in the wilderness. Your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years and bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness. According to the number of the days which you spied out the land, 40 days for each you shall bear your guilt. 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. Right about this time, I can imagine, not to put a humorous spin on it, but those under 20 were glad they were not in the land, spying out the land for 60 days or 80 days. But no one who was 21 lived more than 61 years old, and they died. It's a horrible, horrible scene, but it's important. It was important enough for it to be written up in Psalm 95 that we heard earlier, in Hebrews 3 and 4. All the accusations are answered except one. Then we're going to die in Egypt. We're going to die right there. But you will go back to Egypt, or back to the way of Egypt, and you will wander and wander. In tents, a temporary dwelling. These are the generations to which he speaks. Both Testaments, you will see so many references to the day that Israel rejected God. So now I'd like you to turn back to Leviticus chapter 23. Leviticus chapter 23, verse 43. Again, God says that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. The you and your generations, brethren, where we read in Leviticus, is you. It is us. We are the succeeding generations. And we're to learn something here. As we dwell this week at wherever it is, Marriott, Days Inn, Airbnb, wherever you are, your home, that's your temporary dwelling, both figuratively and possibly literally. We are to remember the wandering of the children of Israel. Why? That they existed in tabernacles. That's what the tabernacles refers to, historically. Existentially and empirically, the basic understanding of the temporary dwelling speaks to this duality. Israel did not believe, but you do. You did, and you will. The fact that you are here at this feast is proof. So we are reenacting in many ways a historical event to remember. I think the emotion that comes to mind most, and I did some checking with people, is gratefulness. We're humbled in some ways that we were given this opportunity. You know what Israel did not understand. Oh, they repented. And you can read that in Numbers. They repented after they found out what the punishment was. Much like a small child. They're not sorry they did it until you tell them what's going to happen now that they've done it. Then they're very, very sorry. I'm sure glad humans in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s are so much different. I'm not any different. But that's the other part of tabernacles, is to rejoice, to be well pleased and glad that God has given us this incredible information. This word tabernacles also connotes one other thing, the aspect of protection. Turn with me, if you would, to Psalm 27. There are so many verses that this concept of the tabernacle or the sukkah as protection is throughout the Bible in the concept of a tabernacle. In verse 1, chapter Psalm 27, the Lord is my light and my salvation. There's some beautiful music that has been put to this. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked come against me to eat at my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. Though an army may encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war may rise against me, in this I will be confident. One thing I have desired of the Lord, that I will seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the Hebrew is Bas Sukkot, the secret place of his tabernacle, the tent. He shall hide me. He shall set me high on a rock. Psalm 31 says somewhat the same. He will keep me secretly in his tabernacle from strife and of tongues. Although God punished Israel severely, His love was exhibited to them over and over and over again. His love was exhibited especially for the young, in that he let them live. He could have easily said, "You will wander for 100 years. There is no way anyone alive will stay alive in that wilderness. You'll all be dead. You'll all be gone." But he did not. Kyle and Delitzsch, in their commentary, says this: "Their dwelling, Israel's dwelling in booths, was by no means intended to bring before the minds of the people the unsettled wandering life of the desert. But it was to place vividly before the eyes of the future generations of Israel a memorial of grace, care, protection, which God afforded to his people in the great and terrible wilderness." But there's more. God also said he would provide the fire and the cloud to lead Israel, and he did. Exodus 23 says he will send the angel of Yahweh, or Yahovah. He would go before them and protect them. Be careful that he would protect them. He would not forgive their sins, though he had the capability of doing so. Who was this angel? I refer you to 1 Corinthians 10 and Jude and many New Testament references. We believe that that was Jesus Christ in the wilderness. He was the presence of God. The presence and the fire and the cloud was Jesus Christ. Jude 1:5, if you want to turn there. Jude says, "I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe." It was Jesus who was there with them in the wilderness, who followed them through their wanderings before and after the time in Numbers. The United Church of God teaches that Christ personally watched over Israel. God the Father, through Jesus Christ, knew Israel's every move in the wilderness. He never left them. Christ was there. Jesus Christ, brethren, is in the feast. Jesus Christ is in all the holy days. And that's what matters. That's what's important. The Church of God's distinctive, I believe, is this: Jesus Christ in the holy days. He is in each and every one of them. This is the root of our belief. This protection that God provides is through Jesus Christ in his very self. That God, his Son, sent his Son as a sacrifice for his people is pictured in the holy days and in so many ways during the Feast of Tabernacles. And that is so important. If indeed we say we observe the Feast of Tabernacles solely because, quote unquote, and I've heard this through the years, that's what God commands, that isn't sufficient. That makes you a confused Jew. If we do not have Jesus Christ in the holy days, that's a problem. That makes all the difference to us in the world. They go together, the commands of God and Christ in them. And the plan of salvation is pictured. The alternative is to abandon the holy days. Just keep those other days. They're not in the Bible. But we believe these things and we observe these days because God tells us, because Jesus observed these days, and that Jesus himself is in these days. We keep them because Jesus kept them, and he will keep them in the future. There are three aspects, I think, that Tabernacles teaches us: past, present, and future. I do not think we can divorce ourselves from the historical past, and we should not. The historical past teaches us so much. It tells us that though Israel sinned, they are a lesson for us. 1 Corinthians 10 tells us that, in fact, what happened to Israel is an example to us, to teach us, to believe, to be grateful, to understand that God was with them. And that understanding of God through Christ was with them in the wilderness. He leads them to what we heard as rest and peace. Today is the first day of the rest of your life in the future. When this day comes in its fullness, which we'll get to in the future, it will be rest and peace for not only you as believers, but also the world. It brings us to the present. When God asks us that we reenact a part of history, famous history, in this temporary dwelling, as with Israel, Christ is with us today. We have invoked his name no less than 3 or 4 times already this feast in our prayers. I know you did when you came here. You asked, I'm sure, that God would be with us at the feast, that Jesus Christ would be with us. Jesus is with us today. He watches over our dwellings. God does through Jesus Christ. My wife reminded me recently, does this time not only also picture the physical wanderings in life? She's got the theology training. I had science. She's right. It does picture our life and our temporary dwelling. Mr. Kubik brought it up in the film. We are temporary. No one here is going to live 200 years in a physical life. Take it to the bank. You're not even going to get close. If you get halfway there, that's a miracle in and of itself. We are temporary, and yet we are protected. We are protected through great trials that we've all seen and great blessing. He was with us. Many people here today have suffered horribly financially. We always have people who do. They will probably go back to no job, or a lessened job, or a questionable job. Many have suffered a year they would just as soon forget, and they endure it still. Life is wandering in a tent. This is just a tent. That's all it is. But God said to Israel, your shoes, and I brought my shoes, your sandals would never wear out. This was a feast gift I made. They're fairly clean. I'm sorry about this. I was going to bring, somebody asked, why don't you bring the old sandals? I said, because they're grungy looking. Well, that would have been more poignant. I said, yeah, but they'd have to disinfect the pulpit. These are new. God said to Israel, your sandals never wore out. Your clothing never wore out. I protected you. Life is temporary. And yet, your acknowledgement of his great works in your life, and each and every one of you do, are evidenced by you being here. We honor and we thank God about the way he has watched over us. That's what this feast is about in the presence. As you lay your head down tonight, wherever you are, whether it's a tent at the beach, and I know there's some people who stay in tents, or in a four-walled concrete hotel, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter where you are. When you lay your head down on your pillow at night and a roof over your head, of some kind, you know that God protects us. He watches over us. It is emblematic of this feast of rest and peace, even to a degree in this life. Even in this life, we have rest and peace, that God has covered us, and it leads us to the future. Jesus Christ will return with the clouds to usher the millennium. And many others, I know because of the speakers' conference, will be speaking of the millennium. I did not want to drag you back into the world or back into your life, but I think it's important that we spend some time in that. We cannot appreciate a future of unbelievable harmony, peace, and rest, and being with Jesus Christ until we understand he has been with us all our lives. The future, he will return with clouds, and he will bring a type of rest for 1,000 years. And we will be with Jesus Christ as he and we prepare the world for God himself, which is in the 8th day. That day that begins that millennium is today. It's today is the beginning of the millennium. So let me conclude. As we begin this feast, remind yourselves Remind yourselves of the great works of God. Many of you, I got to tell you, old friends that we haven't seen in either months or years, we asked, how's it going, what's happening? And God has done great, great works in many of your lives. Remind yourself of that. Quietly, if that's what it needs to be. As God asks us, remember Israel. They dwelt in tents to remind us of the lesson. Take stock of how God has protected you, watched over you, your family, your friends, your church. He may not protect us just exactly as we wish, but because he is a God, the God, he knows what's best. Share, if it's appropriate, with others, as I was shared with, of those works, those wonderful deeds that God has done. Celebrate. Rejoice at the feast with friends and with family. And as was said earlier, I have it in my notes. This feast, I give you a challenge. Make five, at least five, brand new friends. I've all met you, so, and you met me as of today. So you only got four to go. Four in the rest of a week. Meet four new friends. Picture this day as the future, as a time of rest. Because indeed, that time of the future will be the rest of your life. Have a wonderful, wonderful Feast of Tabernacles, brethren.